This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Sephora stores are everywhere you are, so just pop in when you need a brown lip to match your 90s playlist, a confidence boost before your interview, or a last-minute gift for mom's birthday. There's always a Sephora near you. Just pop in. Use our store locator to find your local Sephora or Sephora at Kohl's.
Hello, and welcome to Slate's Audio Book Club, the reality version. I'm here with Troy Patterson, Slate's wonderful TV critic. This is Megan O'Rourke, one of Slate's culture critics. Hello, Troy.
Hi, Megan.
Hi, Troy. And our special guest today, Jody Rosen, Slate's wonderful music critic. Hello, Jody.
Hello, Megan.
Today we're talking about Reality Hunger, a manifesto by David Shields. And there's a lot to get into with this book, which is it's a nonfiction book. It calls itself a manifesto. I think one of the things we should ask ourselves is whether it really is a manifesto. And it's arranged in 618 sections in chapters going from A to Z, from overture to coda. And one of the distinguishing qualities of the book is that many, many, many of these fragments or these paragraphs are borrowed almost verbatim, in many cases verbatim, from other writers, so that we have a kind of palimpsest of quotation arranged in such a way it suggests as to make an argument about our relationship as artists to quote-unquote reality. Just to give our listeners a taste of what the beginning of this book sounds like, the very opening lines say, "Every artistic movement from the beginning of time is an attempt to figure out a way to smuggle more of what the artist thinks is reality into the work of art." A couple lines down, Shields writes, "My intent is to write the Ars Poetica for a burgeoning group of interrelated but unconnected artists in a multitude of forms and media: lyric essay, prose poem, collage novel, visual art, film, television, radio, performance art, rap, stand-up, comedy, graffiti, who are breaking larger and larger chunks of, quote, reality into their work." That quotation mark, I think, is something we're going to have to ask ourselves some questions about. So, big claim here and a big statement about what the book is going to do. So I think it's worth untangling. One of the things I felt about the book was that there were a lot of different strands all tangled up. And I think it's worth untangling David Shields' many tangled threads about, quote unquote, this reality.
Do you think they're strands, or is it more like a stew?
Ooh, good question. Well, stew is interconnected and mingled, and strands are, I think they're strands in a lot. Okay. I think actually there are three strands and then there's one stew. That's my theory. We can get into that. Right. I actually was thinking about this last night. I think there are several strands and then there's like a stew. So there's a bunch of different arguments, and I'll just name a couple and then stop talking. One of them is about the novel not being a dominant form anymore, right? And Shields, I should say, is a novelist. He's written many novels along with other nonfiction books. But so there's an anxiety here about the novel and its place in the culture, right? There's an argument about the pleasures of cultural appropriation of things like sampling. And Jody, I'm hoping we'll get you to talk a bit about that. And in some ways, this book is sort of a screed against copying. copyright law. It's a defense of borrowing, the kind of borrowing that goes on here in the book. And there's many, many more elements. Before I keep talking and bore us all to death, I want to ask you, what did you think of this book? Did it seem useful? Is it a manifesto? What element struck you most? And how would you describe this stew, Troy?
I'm not certain that it writes as a manifesto. I'm swayable on this point, but doesn't a manifesto have to have a point of view?
One thinks. I spent the first 20 pages being like, where's the manifesto in this manifesto? Yeah.
I think by labeling it a manifesto, it's a kind of branding, which is partly maybe meant to excuse its sort of, I wouldn't even call its form episodic. It's pastiche-ish nature. How do I want to say it?
Pastiche.
Yes, it's pastiche. You know, upon first glance, I spent 15 seconds with the book and decided that it looked like a fake in the context of no context to invoke the great sort of spectral media age meditation by, do I pronounce his last name Tro or Trow?
Tro. I do.
George W.S.
Tro. I don't know how you do, but. Well,
yeah, so this is in that genre. David Shields is clearly a bright guy. And I like his references, both the books he mentions and the ones he swipes from. He does a good job of sort of loitering on the shoulders of giants. But the book is it's way undercooked, as I think its sort of episodic pastiche nature indicates.
And you know, he tries to excuse the fact that it's undercooked. He builds in escape hatches or apologies in this really, like, one of his in paragraph section number 6, it's simply, I need say nothing, only exhibit, which I guess if we go to, there's an appendix that and that's a Walter Benjamin quotation, but and later on in the book, section 384 begins, the lyric essay doesn't expound, is suggestive rather than exhaustive, depends on gaps, may merely mention. So he sort of builds in this apology for his lack of cogency in this book, for his lack of an argument.
But you know, okay, sorry,
no, go ahead, please.
What's interesting to me about this book is that let me just start by saying I'm very sympathetic to Shields' project. I feel like my aesthetics are quite similar to his. I like the fragmentary. I love David Markson's This Is Not a Novel. I love the idea of the kind of novel built on pieces of information. I love Camera Lucida, which is a sort of seemed like another almost model for this, right? These kind of fragmentary, aphoristic pieces. But when you read that quote, Jody, I thought, well, this book is exhaustive as well as being exhausting. It's just, it's actually not that fragmentary. It's trying to contain so much and not be suggestive. It's almost kind of the opposite of suggestive. It keeps telling us the same things over and over and over. It's insistive, if that were a word.
And I think that a lot of what it is insisting upon would be evident to anyone who is inclined to pick up a book like this in the first place.
Yes.
Like when he mentions that there was this thing that happened with mechanical reproduction that changed the way that communication happened.
We've heard
that one before.
Jody, do you want to just, you mentioned the index and I realized we didn't describe that part of it, and it is a relevant part of the book, and I didn't mean to cut you off, but I thought if you want to.
No, not at all. So many of the 618 fragments, sections, aphorisms, whatever we're calling these things that make up the book. Many of them, as you say, are culled from other sources. He at one point in the book says that he's quoting but not verbatim. So he'll amend quotations from sources. So for instance, if you look in the appendix, you'll find that section 39 comes from Rob Grier for a new novel, and he notes the book that in many ways got me thinking about all this stuff. He quotes from Philip Roth. He quotes from Vivian Gornick. He quotes from John Mellencamp. So this kind of exquisite corpse of ideas and aphorisms and thought is, you know, both his and it's lifted from all these sources. And that, I mean, it seems to me that that's his attempt to formally mirror his argument is, I guess, interesting and could work if the argument was coherent. And I'm not sure. I mean, he's saying, you know, that he loves appropriation and he hates stringent copyright law, and that all these vital current art forms are built on appropriation and sampling, literal and figurative. And again, my reaction is a little bit like Troy's. Yeah, we know this. So, I mean, you know, I mean, yeah. I guess the book functions as a kind of an interesting anthology of not entirely related thoughts, but
I
hate to say it, I was thinking that myself. Not that I've tried it out, but never know. But I get, for me, I keep bumping up against what does he mean by reality. It's unclear. I mean, he puts scare quotes around reality, but it's unclear to me whether he means the objective reality of, you know, everyday life, whether he means artworks which purport to, which, you know, have a verite quality. And he seems all over the place about
reality. The charitable way to look at things is that the book, that maybe its mission is to capture what reality is, to go seeking a definition of this slipperiest of terms, you know, in which, you know, and any book that tried to do that would be doomed to fail. Then the problem is just to fail in an interesting way.
Yeah, I mean, I think we should. What does he mean by reality? When I was reading the book, I wrote in my little flap here that there's a lot of different kinds of reality in this book, which I guess charitably, right, we could say that's one of its strengths. It seems like it's trying to kind of encompass and say something about the moment, but to do it through fragmentation and through juxtaposition and to kind of convey some of the concatenation of the culture we live in and the kind of extraordinary juxtapositions of source material that you know, artists use now, from John Cougar Mellencamp to Rob Grier, right? Like that kind of juxtaposition seems really important to the work of this book. But kind of one of my problems with the book, and I don't mean to merely focus on the negative, but I guess it's actually kind of relevant. Like, the beginning I thought was the weakest part of the book. I thought it got much stronger, actually, as it went along. But the beginning is this awfully potted history of writing. Mm. And then a long chapter on James Frey, which I thought was just utterly kind of boring and rehashed from a lot of the quotes there are from newspapers and, you know, magazines. And it just felt like, really, this isn't that interesting. But later in the book, he gets to more of a discussion about collage, about fragmentation, about memory. There's a really interesting section about memory. And tellingly to me, a lot of the quotations there start to come from writers rather than from journalists. And I have to say, the journalistic part of the quotations just felt like the language wasn't that interesting. But I say that by way of giving a sense of like how many different topics there are here. So there's reality in the sense of realism. It seemed to me like there's an argument about kind of the novel and realism. Then there seemed to be like reality meaning the new distribution channels for art. Mm-hmm. Right? There was a lot of how we get art, how we make art, and that seemed to be part of the reality that he's trying to evoke. Then there's the reality of there's a kind of obsession with novelty, it seemed to me, the sense that like forms get tired and then therefore they become kind of mired in their own artifice. But I didn't know whether these were all reality or whether these were all different.
And I would add, there's also he seems to me to be a bit of an authenticity monger. He's into the idea of the raw and that, you know, the real somehow being unvarnished.
Mm-hmm. But aren't there also some like feints in the other direction?
That's one of the things, right? There's feints in both directions.
Right. And I believe, am I making this up or did I just imagine that regarding this as trying to hold two ideas in mind at the same time, there is
definitely
among the book's self-conscious riffs, one on negative capability.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. Mm. And definitely that's part of what I kind of like the most about this book is when it starts to activate those two different things. Because at one point, I had the same thing I wrote in my margin. Wait, he's just said he wants the raw, but then here he's talking about high aesthetics. And then you get to the point where he talks the great Fitzgerald quote about the sign of a great mind is you can hold two opposing ideas in your head at the same time. But
you know, one thing that might be useful is to actually read from a passage early in the book where he describes some of the stuff that he thinks comprises our cultural moment, and that he thinks is evidence of this reality hunger, mm-hmm. as he calls it. And he lists, among other things, I'm just going to like read various of the
and this is in
things
section besides. Two
section
I think.
Two yeah. Jeff Krause's Plug In Delete City, the quasi home movie Open Water, Borat. This is one of my favorites, a depilation scene in the 40-year-old version. He goes on and on. Todd Haynes' superstar biopic of Karen Carpenter that uses Barbie dolls as the principal actors and is available now only as a bootleg video. Curb Your Enthusiasm, which, characteristic of this genre, this ungenre, this anti-genre, relies on viewer awareness of the creator's self-conscious, wobbly manipulation of the gap between person and persona. M&M's The M&M Show, The Museum of Jurassic Technology in Los Angeles, VH1's Behind the Music series, which completely confused me, as did he writes, and he goes on, The Bachelor, the reality show The Bachelor, tells us more about the state of unions than any romantic comedy could dream of telling us. I disagree with that completely, but Dave Eggers' heartbreaking work of staggering genius. And the reason I mention all this is I think the idea he's raising here that there is, that we are in a cultural moment which is characterized by works of art that play with verite and that interestingly straddle the line between art, in quotes, and reality, in quotes, is true. And I long for a book that has something really trenchant or novel to say about that. But I think he's just, in my reading, he just kind of lays it out.
But do you think that's especially true now of this moment, since a lot of the collage-like things, practices he's been talking about have been going on for 100 years and
that
not even 100 years.
Questions.
You know, he rightly mentions that the Old Testament is itself an anthology,
a collage.
I mean, you know, that's biblical scholars spend all their time looking
the redaction. This is one of the questions is this, he starts by, I mean, okay, so let's take that central claim that he starts with. I almost thought that he kind of did himself in with the beginning of the book, that if he just hadn't made that claim, the book, I would have read the book very differently. But since he makes this claim that we hunger for reality right now, and then he uses these as his examples. What do we, I mean, do you agree that we hunger for reality right now? And also, I think one problem is that even these examples raise the question of, well, what is that reality? These things all seem like very different kinds of hungering, these cultural artifacts to me.
I hunger right now for an egg sandwich.
Yes.
And what I thirst for is an end to post-modernity.
Exactly.
I thought we were, can we just settle this already? When does a concern with a postmodern end?
Well, I thought it ended here because I wrote in
today?
My book.
In this book.
This wants to be POMO, but it's actually faux pro, meaning faux profound, which I thought was very clever. So irritating. Faux pro. I was like, the faux pro. No, well, you know.
No POMO. That's
no
the new
POMO.
Cry.
No POMO.
You're going to be hearing that in rap song. But I guess one thing that here's one thing that I think is happening. He writes somewhat interestingly in section number 279, I believe, about what I would call the new amateurism. Or that is to say, he talks about Facebook, blogs, YouTube, karaoke, and the fact that everyone's, you know, user-generated content. He says... Yeah. He says, more than a third of adult American internet users have created original content and posted it on the web. That's okay, by now, that's a truism.
Yeah.
Everyone knows it, but it is distinctly characteristic of this period, more than the fact that we live in an age of collage.
Yeah.
Okay, and that to me is interesting, but I'm not sure that he draws any real conclusions about it. And that to me, that to me is a factor of new technology and the historical moment in which we live. It forces that don't have to do with some vague hunger on the part of whomever.
All of us for reality.
But in fact, if anything, it's a factor of celebrity hunger.
Yes, not reality.
Not reality hunger. And the new technologies which enable regular Joes to create.
To be part of it.
And to be
Hear, hear. I would also say that I think part of the problem, he's onto something interesting there and pointing in the right direction, but that's the kind of target that's moving too fast to get a good bead on, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Totally. I mean, and I think actually the list here that you of texts that he references, and by texts I mean just cultural texts of any kind of gets at what you're talking about. Jody, I was writing those notes to myself, and I thought, you know, heartbreaking work of staggering genius, the self-conscious apparatus in that, that has to do with also, I don't think that has to do with feeling that we're being sold stuff all the time, right? And so there is, I think he's
Can I do the ad now?
Oh, speaking of, we might as well. Here's our little bit of reality, which is that we need an ad to support our program.
Yeah. There it is. Today, we're brought to you by Audible.com, which offers lots and lots of downloadable audiobooks. And here's a deal. This is how we reel you in. If you sign up for a one-book-a-month subscription to Audible through our URL, you'll get a credit good for one free book. That book is yours to keep, even if you cancel your subscription within the 14-day trial period, within the fortnight trial period. The URL that you're interested in is www.audiblepodcast.com/slate.
Thank you, Troy.
And now on with the show. Where were we?
Back to authenticity. I would say that, you know, I think part of what he's really getting at, I mean, in that list of things is that we're, I mean, he says after the list, at once desperate for authenticity and in love with artifice, I know all the moments are, quote, moments, staged and theatrical, shaped and thematized. And that's true, and that's kind of a useful thing to say, right? But there's a lot of different things tangled up here, and one of them has to do with being frustrated, wanting to expose the seams of the garment, in a sense, right? That, like, we want to, that's what Eggers is doing in A Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius. He's showing us the ways in which things are put together and sold, and he's deconstructing the form, too. And those things go together. But, you know, to me, The Bachelor is not doing any of that. The Bachelor is, like, high artifice pretending to be kind of reality, and that's a whole different strain of this kind of reality. And so I was hungering myself for him to pick apart these things, because I think that there is some interrelationship, but that a lot of these things are inverses of the others. And in my kind of literal-minded way, I wanted him to, as a critic, kind of pull that all apart. And I felt like he never did. And instead we get in section three this statement that seems so broad as to be not quite useful, and I wonder what you thought of it. He says, an artistic movement, albeit an organic and as yet unstated one, is forming. What are its key components? A deliberate unartiness, raw material, seemingly unprocessed, unfiltered, uncensored, and unprofessional. And he mentions Abraham Zapruder's Super 8 film of the Kennedy assassination as a kind of, you know, influential piece of art. Then he says, randomness, openness to accident and serendipity, spontaneity, artistic risk, emotional urgency and intensity, reader-viewer participation. That, to me, goes back to the technology point you were making. An overly literal tone, as if a reporter were viewing a strange culture. Plasticity of form, pointillism, criticism as autobiography, self-reflexivity, self-ethnography, anthropological autobiography, a blurring of any distinction between fiction and nonfiction, the lore and blur of the real, by which I'm not quite sure what he means there. But, you know, this is a lot of really different kind of things. And I ended up feeling my take on the book ultimately was that there were two books here, and one I was really interested in, and that was a kind of more fragmentary collage about making art and memory, and some of it had to do with distribution channels. And the other book was, to me, what felt like, and this is what you were saying, Troy, about the target moving too fast. The other book was like this kind of potted history of the moment we find ourselves in as artists in a world where technology has radically changed distribution systems. And if you look at it, actually, most of the quotations for the second part, this like kind of potted history of where we are, comes from journalism, and they're long paragraphs, and they're just not linguistically that interesting. And that's heavily at the beginning of the book, and I was really bored by most of that. But when he gets to the kind of more fragmentary collage toward the end, that stuff, I have to say, I really liked a lot of that. And I want to kind of give Shields credit for that, because I feel like I've been really negative. And I actually thought, you know, he talks about memoir, for example, and kind of fragmentation. And I just finished writing a memoir. And I have to say, like, I put the book down and I was thinking a lot about what he said about fragmentation and claims to authority. And none of it's radically new, but there's a pleasing way in which he arranges some of those fragments toward the end. Did you share any of that feeling, or did you?
Yeah. Well, no, he's got a good eye for epigrams, which, you know, I suppose it says something in the case of a book that's about collage and appropriation, that part of his art here is editing and extracting things or paging through Bartlett's or whatever to get some epigrams and koan that are worth musing upon. And I don't know.
Yeah, and he's a good curator. I mean, because this is a curatorial work, you know what I mean? And you know, I sometimes would like cut a paragraph out of the newspaper, stick it in a, you know, in a drawer, whatever. So I feel like he did that well.
You've just reminded me that this book is a little bit like reading someone's journal.
Well, I did think that some of the paragraphs felt like course descriptions from me, and I felt that there were journal moments and also moments where he had kind of pasted in a course description.
Yeah, you know? No, exactly. You know, one thing I'd like to talk about is, like, he has a pathological hatred for the contemporary fiction or the modern novel. And this is, like, this seems to me to be behind this. If there, to the extent that there's a manifesto here, it's that the novel has outworn its the novel on the classical 19th century model has outworn its welcome, and no one is doing anything interesting in the novel. I mean, he's like it's all about the lyric essay, and you know, to me, this was really overheated because I feel like this is a really old argument. And the fact that he's in a lather about it so much mystified me. But I want to read one thing.
Let's quote from one of his,
One thing here in section 379, maybe, he's talking about the film version of Nick Hornby's High Fidelity. And he cites the director, Stephen Frears, who said, quote, "What we realized was that the novel was a machine to get to 12 crucial speeches in the book about romance and art and music and list-making and masculine distance and the masculine drive for art and the masculine difficulty with intimacy," end quote. Shields goes on to say, "This is the case for most novels. You have to read 700 pages to get the handful of insights that were the reason the book was written, and the apparatus of the novel is there as a huge, elaborate, overbuilt stage set." Which, to me, I mean, I'm not sure that I agree that insights are what I want from a novel. And in fact, what if I want the overbuilt stage set?
What if you want a story?
Well, that's precisely it. He's
anti-story.
He's anti-narrative. He's anti-plot.
He talks about, right.
And as someone who loves, like, genre fiction and loves the greatest hacks who've ever written, like P.G. Woodhouse and Georges Simenon, it's you know, I'm all about plot, and story. So I'm not sure that.
Here's a question too. I mean, I'm glad you read that passage because I wrote after that. I just put it in brackets and I wrote no.
I just got a big X by the way.
You know, first of all, also before I go into my question that I'm going to pose to you, there's a characteristic problem right here in this, which is that one of the things that made this book less than successful for me was that Shields, when he's trying to make his own points in his own language, often exaggerates in a way that's just not useful. So he says, you have to read 700 pages to get the handful of insights that were the reason the book was written. And it's like, actually, most novels are not 700 pages. Even if he'd said 200 pages, right. I would be more trusting of this narrative voice. But there is this fascinating distaste for the novel as a story. And now I will confess my sympathies here. I actually like a lot of the kinds of deconstructed lyric novels that he's talking about. My tastes do run in that direction. I mean, I will happily read a long story plotted novel, but at the same time, he seems to go on, and did you see this, Troy, about there's this obsession with the fact that we are unknowable to one another, right? That each of us is unknowable to the other, and he wants to plumb the depths of everyone's unknowability through writing, which I find totally bizarre because that's what novels do. That's what the kind of novel that has character and plot does for me as a reader in a way that nothing else does. Did this seem like a contradiction? What did you make of this part of the book?
I thought it was kind of lame. I mean, I'm trying to... Like, I like a good French new novel, right?
Right.
But, you know, there are a lot of strategies and ways to tell stories, and I think that I don't know that his frustration with the perceived limits of the postmodern novel is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you have an option. You could try to write a Dickens novel.
But it's not even the postmodern novel that he's frustrated with. He's frustrated with all novels, it seems to me. Like the 19th century novel, too.
Yeah,
right?
He's frustrated with the 19th century novel.
He doesn't like story, which is, fundamentally.
Yeah, he doesn't like story. And, I mean, and that's just a little bit strange. I mean, he's...
Yeah, it's like you don't have to be a novelist then.
Right. No one's holding...
And a nonfiction
fact,
writer.
I mean, resonates with me. I don't read a lot of contemporary fiction. I don't enjoy most of it, and I just spend my time consuming other stuff. But I'm not so angry about the exhaustion of the form. Moreover, like, I mean, okay, in certain periods, certain types of... certain media or artistic forms are more vital than others. I think that's all you need to say. And you know, he prefers something that's a little hodgepodgey and collagey. Good for him. I think he's, despite his potted histories, as you call them, mm-hmm. correctly, mm-hmm. he's kind of an ahistorical thinker. Mm. I don't think he's very good at the broader context thing.
What do you mean by that?
Well, it struck me, for instance, in that passage I was talking about earlier, where he was talking about the Bible, and when he champions these collage forms as somehow fundamentally of this moment, there it is. The fact that, you know, we've talked about it. It's something that's been around, as he himself said. At one point, he does mention that the 18th century novel was more postmodern, as everyone knows, you know, that Tristram Shandy is what is, quote, the first postmodern novel, right? And, you know, later he mentioned the Canterbury Tales as a kind of like anthology. So he faints in the direction of saying this thing has gone on for a long time, at the same time as he's saying, right now we have this reality hunger and we're in this unique moment, and leaves it a little bit ill-defined. But one of the places that both his ahistorical thinking and his kind of shallow thinking really hit me with the force of a revelation is when he talks about music, because I know a little something about pop music, and I don't think he does.
But tell us more about that.
Before you get there, one point about the sort of the status or the status of a novel is that I think a version of this argument that does have some historical sense is made by Tom Wolfe, right? His idea is that the withering of the novel has to do with the disdain in certain godforsaken academic and literary circles for stories that are strongly plotted, and that sort of partly as in a status-seeking way that, you know, these sort of like intellectualized thin, I don't mean thin in terms of length, but in terms of meatiness, that these sort of non-novels are ascendant. For that, Wolfe prescribes like big 700-page chunks of social realism. Shields, I think, wants to hit the eject button altogether, and sort of if this book does have any meaning as a manifesto, it's for him to encourage nonfiction writing, essayism perhaps most importantly, but he also gives some examples that involve reporting, period. You know, and one of my frustrations with the book is like, okay, so you're sort of pointing in the direction of, you know, some artistic movement that you'd like to see. Why don't you actually give me the book that you're sort of fantasizing about instead
that's
of...
That's right.
Right. Yeah.
That's one of the
real
questions.
Do you think that he thinks he is giving you that book?
I think in moments he aspires to. I don't know. That was one of my questions, was that. I mean, it starts as a manifesto, but it kind of abandons... I don't know. Because my confusion about this was that Troy, I would take it to be the case that Shields would not agree with Wolfe, that it's precisely the Wolfe account of what fiction should be that he is most tired of, right? That he finds the most conventional, the most not interesting, right?
But he agrees with Wolfe about the... He agrees with Wolfe's diagnosis, though, because I believe Troy is referring to the famous Harper's or Atlantic essay that Wolfe wrote sometime in the late 80s or early 90s, mm-hmm. in which he argued, and also there's a Philip Roth quote in the Shields book which makes the same point, that particularly acutely in American life, reality is outstripping the possibilities of fiction, because we live in such a carnivalesque,
crazy, one of the tensions is, right? Because what he doesn't want is the socially real novel. He doesn't seem that interested
in
that.
No, I'm saying he agrees with Wolfe about the about the diagnosis, but not about
how to solve it. Because in fact, the kinds of novels that he's making a case for are books like David Markson's This Is Not a Novel. He quotes David Markson, and Markson is aesthetically and formally, this book reminds me of a Markson book. Markson's books are fragmented, especially This Is Not a Novel, is these fragmented sections. Many, many of them are quotations from philosophers or taken from letters of artists. And I think that book, This Is Not a Novel, is an extraordinary book. It's beautiful. It's lyrical. It's suggestive. The language is really intense. It gives you a kind of experience to read the book that is, I think, the kind of experience that he wants us to have reading this book. He talks at one point, I've lost the page here, but about kind of fragmentation. Let me just find the quote. And I think this is what he wants to do here, is he wants to create a book that's like David Markson's book. And in fact, on section 334, he talks about, I think, what he wants to do here, which is, he says, momentum in literary mosaic derives not from narrative, but from the subtle progressive buildup of thematic resonances. And that seems to be the kind of book he wants to create. But to me, again, just to harp on this, that's hampered by all the kind of leaden, long quoting from kind of not that well-written journalism at the beginning of the book. But he does want to have more nonfiction in it, but I don't think he wants to give up on that. It's like watching someone struggle with themselves, right? It's a kind of Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, like in the moment of transformation, because he keeps kind of making the call for nonfiction and complaining about the novel, but clearly he's not given up on fiction altogether, or it seemed to me. That was one of the questions, was that, like, why all of this?
Right. Do we, and I'm not sure that that's a sufficient conflict to work as a story. Again, a story. Another good book, another good fragmentary sort of spooky book that he mentions is Speedboat, Renata Adler's Speedboat.
Which I love.
That has the benefit of being a book that's about something other than itself. Right. This is a very sort of self-reflexive. The reality hunger is this snake here that wants to eat its own tail. And I think that that is of limited utility. That said, it has instigated this discussion, which I find engaging enough. But then again, I'm the one having it. Is this a useful conversation?
Right. I wonder whether any of our listeners will say, well, here's what I, because I feel I've been kind of ragging on David Shields, whose work I like and whose aesthetic I'm sympathetic to. And I think actually for me, I got fixated on this manifesto part of the book and partly on the fact that there's so much, he's trying to contain so much. But I will say what I took away that was really useful. And again, so to talk about myself for a moment, I'm writing this memoir, and one of the things that I'm trying to do in the memoir is write about the experience of writing, because it's very, you're quite aware that you're constructing a story. When you're constructing a story out of your life, you're quite aware of all the ways in which you're using artifice to do so. And for me, one of the really useful things about this book that I'm thinking a lot about, and I thought he was really right about, is the assertion that, you know, memoir, reminding us that memoir really is literature and not journalism, and that it is an artificial construct, and that to kind of foreground that, or to find ways to foreground that, is really useful. And I think that some of the writing in this book reminded me, felt like it came out of the predicament of being a creative writing teacher. You know what I mean? Like, I wonder what people who are in writing programs, if they would have a kind of different reaction to this book than people. I ended up wondering who this book was for in a certain way, because I do think...
The tenure committee.
I do think that maybe there's like an argument he has with someone who's given a lecture who is dismissive of Katherine Harrison's The Kiss, and he includes that letter to this person in the book. And I thought it was a really telling moment, because I think that some of what he's arguing against are kind of people in the academy who've staked out a position as a fiction professor, right? And that there's this kind of like hardening of genre when you're in the academy, that maybe when you're not in the academy, and as he's rightly pointing out, like there's all these examples of blurring everywhere. I sort of long-windedly didn't really answer your question, Troy, but I want to also make sure we go back to your thing about music, Jody.
Yeah, you know, there's a section where he talks a lot about popular music, and in particular about hip-hop, and predictably extols sampling, which struck me as curious. Well, one thing that's interesting, just in terms of sampling as such, that is to say, sampling snatches of other records by digital means and, you know, putting a beat behind them and creating a new song, that happens a lot today, but not nearly as much as it did 10, 15, 20 years ago. So it feels a little behind when he talks about that. And he, you know, talk about potted histories. He's like, well, the Jamaican DJ did this back in the 60s, and then it mutated in the Bronx into hip hop. It's like, okay.
Yeah. He also writes as if he just discovered mashup.
I know.
No, all this stuff is, so that is all a little weird. But then he gets into a discussion of hip hop's cult of the real and, you know, keeping it real and stuff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I feel like there's two different things going, because he's extolling hip hop as this great, as this genre, which is all about appropriation and kind of layered texts, which I agree, and that's one of the things that's really exciting about hip-hop is the way and now, because of the primacy of hip-hop, it's suffused lots of popular music, particularly, you know, pop music with a capital P. There's a blurring between the persona of the singer. You know, often singers are quite self-referential in their songs in a way that they, maybe they weren't before the advent of hip-hop. So broadly, they were on occasion, but, you know, there's lots of songs in which Beyoncé sings about being Beyoncé.
Yeah.
Or Beyoncé sings about in scare quotes, being Beyoncé or a celebrity. Right. So that's and that's all interesting. But you know, the real in hip hop is like a metaphor system, is really what it is. Hmm. It's like, you know, it's a theme. It's a leitmotif, or not even a leitmotif, but that would suggest that it's like too little. It's one of the major themes of hip hop, but it's not.
End of life, I would say.
End of life. End of life. But I mean, like,
end of the novel, of certain novels, but Spalding's romance.
But specifically, the cult of street credibility.
Right.
And, you know, gangsta bona fides or whatever, you know, that's a theme of hip hop, but that's different from the reality hunger, I think, that he's talking about.
Yeah.
And he doesn't parse that, I don't think.
I think he humbles himself with this opening, because I think that actually part of what he wants to do in this book, and you're hitting on it, and we can give him credit for this, is he's consciously trying to do that, right? He's trying to include everything in a way. Like, he wants to include everything in order to create this kind of concatenation. So he wants to have lots of different kinds of reality and investigate them all. But because he starts by trying to evoke a specific kind of movement or moment, those two things are in tension with each other, because the specificity of a moment in which certain things are happening is not the same thing as the kind of inclusive, let me interrogate reality in all of these different ways. Like, that's just too big to be connected to. Because, I mean, one question I had for you, Jody, is, you know, he talks about The Bachelor, and then he talks about hip-hop sampling, and he acts as if there's a suggestion that there's something similar about their appropriation of the real, right, of the kind of intrusion of real life. Is there? I mean, is there some? Is The Bachelor like, you know, like a Kanye West song that samples Ray Charles, or is Open Water like a Kanye West song that samples Ray Charles? I mean, to me, no. But
yeah, no.
Maybe
I mean,
like, I'm missing something.
You know, well, The Bachelor, it seems to me, is about
or America's
narrative.
Next Top Novel, you know, or whatever. I mean,
like,
it is.
Those things are like reality shows are saga. They're stories. They're like, you know, serialized sagas. And I think that's why people go back to them, is because there's a narrative. The same is true of American Idol. You know what I mean? There's an ongoing saga which lasts a full season, and you're hooked in by the characters and the story. The fact that they purport to be more real than a scripted drama gives them, I would agree with Shields, a certain texture that's fun, or that like is it's different. But of course, you know, now all these things have kind of ossified into, you know, they're formalized. They're so formalized as to be, you know, the wink of the reality and reality TV.
It's the hills,
yeah, right.
Is
right.
It's,
right. And so in that sense, they're sort of all a grand joke in which we all know the punchline.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like I'll say the one. I'm coming back to the same section. You know, where Shield is talking about karaoke and MySpace and Twitter and Flickr and things like that. And he says, you know, user made content is the new folk art, and that is true, and it really, and that really is something that I'd like to think and know more about. And, you know, Troy said that it's too fast of a moving target because we're right in the middle of it, and, you know, Shields doesn't effectively pin it down. But an example of something that that Shields kind of gestures at, but I don't think quite makes sense of, he talks about, and this is another instance of his writing about music, he talks about the cover song and karaoke, and how somehow this is an example of, this is a manifestation of reality hunger. And here's where he's hobbled by his ahistoricism, or his just like not knowing enough or thinking deeply enough about this stuff. You know, it's right. I think of one of the real icons of pop music at this point, I'd argue, is the YouTube cover song, like the bedroom cover song by an amateur. And there's a lot of things going on there. I think it's like canon making information. It's like, you know, everybody now having the technology, the means to have their 15 minutes. So everybody's rehearsing their own stardom. It's also the example of Justin Bieber, now a superstar who began that way. He was discovered by doing this stuff. So it's, you know, it's a path to celebrity. But it's also a return to the past. It's a return to the Victorian model of popular music where the parlor piano was the site. You know, the pop music was consumed as sheet music, and it was a participatory sport that took place around the parlor with your family. So it's the re-domesticization of popular music.
That's really interesting. Yeah,
and that to me is like, that's the interesting stuff that's going on there. I'm not sure that what reality hunger has to do with it. And so I mention this only because like this is the section of Shields' book that I feel like I have a stake in. I feel like I have a stake in it all, but like I know a little something about this, the history, and he just reveals himself to be a little bit shallow in his thinking about it. Moreover, like ahistorical, it's like I just don't think he's done his homework or thought about this in quite the right way, and it just feels slapdash.
So it's interesting because I mean I think you know he's right. It seems to me that he's right that there's this emergence of a kind of return to cultural products, or not a return, but there's an emergence or a reemergence. We can table that question of cultural products that are stripping away the artifice of kind of being overtly made, right? So we're moving from the sitcom to Survivor. We're moving from the hour-long drama to America's Next Top Model, right? Whatever it be that this happens in the 90s, and then the internet is blossoming, and we get the kind of fascination with YouPorn. And, you know, he's onto, like, there's clearly something there, right? Like, he's right that there's some interest in kind of stuff that seems to represent people, everyday American people. And now, whether we call that, my question is that reality hunger, or is that kind of like democracy hunger? Is that, as you say, maybe that is actually a return to the way things were before. Maybe the anomaly here is the 1950s model of cultural distribution, which is the emergence of television as a huge, you know, basically the early 20th century, the sort of first half of the 20th century, you suddenly have mass media, which you didn't have before that. Maybe that's the anomaly, and we're just returning to what we had before mass media. And
well, but now because of the way that media has changed, where earlier there was folk art with the living room piano, now it's folk product that goes wherever.
Right. And I thought that is one of the interesting parts of the book, like the section you were quoting from, Jody. I thought it was interesting to think about karaoke as connected to YouPorn and connected. Like to me, that was a moment where I was like, sat up and kind of took interest. But I don't know what to say. Is that, Troy, do you think that's reality hunger, all of these things? Where do you think that they come from, this kind of surge of material?
I just kind of spaced out on that question. So instead, what I'll say is that there's one sort of little thingy that I would have liked to see included in this book. Do you ever have these conversations with actors or young actresses at cocktail parties, where you get to talking about their craft and they go into this old...
All the time.
Wait, what? I think I do too,
And they go into this whole spiel about how it's sort of like we in real life are the actors and they on stage are sort of inhabiting reality and being themselves.
Huh. I haven't actually had that
something like
conversation.
That
usually it's about the latest protein diet that they're on. Sorry.
Go ahead. Does Shields mention the method, like method acting in here? Because that strikes me as a mid-century version of this, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, there's not very much in here on... it's mostly literary minded. Even when it talks about film, it's talking about it in a way that's very much auteurist and sort of screenplay focused.
So you wanted more
That was a throwaway line.
Okay. you just wanted Jody. No, turning back to Jody then. He's got his hand up.
You know what I would have liked to see sharpened here is it strikes me that someone in this discussion was mentioning it earlier, the fact that we've been bombarded for decades now with advertising, assaulted with advertising in a way that I think has raised everyone's suspicions about reality. Mm-hmm. And the way that advertising and political culture have become enmeshed or conflated. I think there's something there. You know, he cites, like, was it Donald Rumsfeld who talked or Richard Perle, or who was the guy in the Bush administration who had the reality-based community line?
Famous Rumsfeld.
Rumsfeld. Okay, fine.
When he talks here about reality-based art, which seems to be a conscious riff of that. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And, I mean, and, you know, George Bush and truthiness and all that. I think there's something to the fact that we have these artistic forms, these cultures, pop culture that's invested in truthiness, and that you know, mockumentary and verite, quote unquote verite, sitcoms are all the rage. You know what I mean? I think there's an interesting political atmosphere that's contributes to the rise of these forms. I don't know whether that is what he means by reality hunger, but
he gets at that at one point because he talks about the fictitiousness of our times. He quotes someone who's talking about the fictitiousness of our times.
I think that was Michael Moore's Oscar acceptance.
That was Michael Moore, right? Exactly. That's what it was. Yeah, and, you know, I guess we should wrap this up. Were you going to say anything else? I mean, I keep coming back to this idea that there's really at least two books here, several different kinds of work, because the parts, there were a lot of little things I jotted down. There's a great, so example 470 is a great line from Yeats where he writes, "All that is personal soon rots. It must be packed in ice or salt." And so there are these intrusions of moments like that. The book becomes more like that as it goes on, where he's quoting from more people like Yeats or Nietzsche or Emerson, and the language just gets much more interesting, and the arrangement to me becomes much more interesting. And and I think that some of what he's saying about kind of collage and intensity and art, like, that's all stuff that I'm kind of grateful for, and I feel we've been like ragging
too
on
harsh.
This book. No. I didn't, it's not that I feel we've been too harsh, but, you know, in case David Shields listens to this or people who like this book listen to this, I would say, you know, it did make me think about all these issues, which I was grateful for. And I do think that the chapter on memory and a couple of the other chapters work really, really well and were interesting.
Right.
So that was, for me, the takeaway was, as it went on, I liked it much more.
Right.
And I was interested in a kind of cocktail party way to think about some of these things, but I felt like there was just too much recycling, like I wrote down at one point. This is a book, it's not a book I would give to someone, the first half I wrote this in, it's not a book I would give to a student of mine who came to me to think about, like, what these genres mean right now, but it would give it to Rip Van Winkle if he had just woken up, you know? Because, like, the beginning is just, there's so much of that kind of telling us what we already know about. But what about you, Troy and Jordy? Was there anything you want to say before we sign off that you did take away from this? Or
I would say, along the same lines, I'm looking now at note 143 in this book, mm-hmm. Which quotes the Dogma 95 manifesto, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Spearheaded years ago by our dear Lars von Trier. And so it's, you know, shooting must be, this is how you make a movie if you sign this manifesto. I would point out that Lars only made one such movie and then jettisoned this. But shooting must be done on location and props and sets must not be brought in. The sound must never be produced apart from the images or vice versa. The camera must be handheld, yada, yada, yada. So this comes to mind because, or if I can back my way into this, I found this book annoying, but it's a useful annoyance, much like a provocateur like Lars von Trier is.
Thank you. I guess I was trying to say.
I think so, right?
Yeah.
I like what we're thinking about. I also feel like a bit guilty. Is it just my own neurosis that I feel like what did we produce here?
And I know.
Did we arrive at any clearer understanding of humanity?
No.
or the pleasures of
or
life
of this
and art?
Book, or of this book. I feel like, but I feel in a way we're mimicking a bit of the problem with the the book, which is to say that the book wants to set out, seems to purport to say that it's going to disentangle some things and be a manifesto, but it never did for me. So I feel like I'm just replicating, and I feel like I have not done a good. I haven't added anything to anyone's lives in this conversation, but I've enjoyed myself, and I would like to thank David Shields for giving me that particular pleasure, and apologize to our listeners for failing to be illuminating.
I'd like to make the same apology. I guess I'd say that I like Troy's idea about a good bathroom read here. Yeah. I mean, and that's a product of the form, and I enjoy the fact that this book is broken into these 618 sections. It's a fun. For something that's heavy going and sometimes and often or maybe even usually incoherent in terms of like the broader argument it's making. It's kind of a breezy, fun read simply because it's because of the way it's broken up. And I sort of made fun of Shields at the beginning for his letting himself off the hook by saying that this book was suggestive rather than coherent. But it is suggestive.
Yeah.
It's suggestive of a lot of questions that are out there. So maybe I should just take him at his word and say, okay, it's suggestive, and try and extract what I can from it. So in that sense, yeah, it's funny. This isn't a book that I would say is a great book, but it's not a book that I would say don't read.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think I wanted it to be more suggestive because I felt like it kind of was a little bit pedantic. I do appreciate that it argues with itself, which is something maybe
I would encourage the young, bright minds of today to read it so that they can vastly improve on it.
Yeah.
I have one last question about this, which is one thing we didn't mention is the number of blurbs huge that are on the cover of the book.
Cover of the whole book, actually.
Right. And blurbs from Jonathan Lethem, Jeff Dyer, Wayne Kostenbaum, Charles
Baxter. Lydia Davis.
Frederick Bartlemy, Philip Lopez.
Do these people owe him favors?
The question is, do they owe him favors? And this is obviously a stunt on his part. I mean, this is obviously he's being cheeky here, right?
Yeah,
he's being cheeky here. But the question is, because I mean, I guess this is truthiness. He's suggesting that he's making a comment about the practice of blurbing and endorsement, or is that what is he doing there? Does anyone have a theory?
I don't know. It's nice to see Wayne Kestenbaum's name on the cover because he does interesting work, sort of work that is coherent and makes sustained arguments. He's got a nice little Warhol book.
He was my first writing professor.
No, but I found myself wondering, were these actual blurbs? Did he
think they're actual blurbs.
They don't
seem ironic. They don't seem strange enough to be not actual blurbs.
Right. But so why? He's obviously saying something. The question is what?
I guess I'm back for
and maybe
me.
That's the maybe. I mean that you know the very the cover of the book encapsulates the problem of the book.
Sure.
Or is that a question from the marketing department at Knopf?
Or a question?
I think we need to end this conversation.
Or a question for our listeners.
Yeah, right.
With gratitude for everyone for tuning in, we're sorry if we were not as crisp and cogent as we might perhaps have been, but we did enjoy our conversation, and we hope you did too, and that you will tune back in for our next audiobook club. And Jody and Troy, I want to thank you for joining me today. Thanks for coming in to talk about reality and hunger.
Keep it real.
Thanks, Megan.
Okay. For Slate.com, I'm Megan O'Rourke.